This is OTB Sports Radio, Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
When you lose a big match like that, you have to soak that up. But to go into a dressing room and say you're celebrating to be disrespectful, I mean, who is Mourinho to talk about disrespect?
The best analysis of all the week's football from Ireland's number one football man.
Pogba's a social media star. Right, he appeals to the young people now. He does his dance, he has his hair and all that. That's all he's worried about, in my opinion. Now, worry about being a great player, Nathan.
John Giles. Every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio. Live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now then, Wednesday Night Rugby. Keith Wood, hello.
How are you, Joe? How are you getting on?
Very well. And you've roped in a hell of a guest for us this evening, I'm happy to say. 20 stellar years at the BBC. We're talking Six Nations, we're talking Olympics, Wimbledon, Masters, the Open, Ryder Cups. And ultimately, his camera phone and his dogs have been his greatest triumph. You know what I'm talking about. Have a watch.
Right, guys, thanks for joining us. Just keen to have a chat about where we are and the situation at the moment. I think you're both there. Olive, hi, thanks for joining us. Mabel, you are connected, but you need to start your video. It's down at the bottom of the screen, it's a camera. It looks like a biscuit. If you just nudge it with your nose, you should. There we are. And you don't have to be so close if you want to move back a bit. All right, thanks.
Andrew Carter.
Hello.
What brand of crazy was that? Was that cabin fever at its greatest or?
So the brand of crazy hasn't really changed for the last few months. It's getting a bit crazier, in fact. I think from there, when I went on to make a little documentary, a mockumentary, it got even crazier. And perhaps even more to come. Who knows? But can I say, first of all, I didn't realize we were in vision. So this is what you have to think about now, obviously, when you're doing these things. And I didn't. I would have arranged some very very heavy books behind me there, and some Noam Chomsky or something. But instead, we've got, I don't know, some cleaning products. And I've just taken down the ironing board that hangs on the door. So, but this is the room that I did the Zoom meeting with my dogs in. So I suppose it is quite fitting.
You must have had a moment where you hadn't checked your phone in a few hours and then suddenly clicked on it and it had exploded.
I mean, that was the first video, actually, it did that, which is the one where they're eating their breakfast. And then the second, because I think that's got up to about 11 million views now. And the second one, where they were just fighting over a bone, went to 20 million. But the speed with which it was getting, retweets and likes, you know, Woody's all about social media. He loves it, absolutely loves it. So he can recognize all this. But it was absolutely insane. And I think it was because everyone was locked down. It was literally a captive audience, and people were looking for anything silly to cling on to as well. But having said that, even now, I went the other day and just filmed them running into a pond. It was a 25 second video of very little creativity at all, and that's had a million views. So I don't, maybe the world's just stayed a bit crazy.
Keith, you're familiar with the exploits of Oliver and Mabel, I hope.
Olive and Mabel.
You've gender swapped them there. Olive and Mabel. Olive is. It's definitely Olive.
Is it? Olive and Mabel.
I got one of the reasons I went for Labradors because of Keith's dogs as well. I love Labradors anyway, but because he's got Jacqueline and Cisco, because he's got Jake and Cisco,
yeah, that's right,
yeah, exactly.
Well, it's funny because Andrew and I have been friends for years, and I don't know, it was about 4 or 5 years ago he rang and said, listen, I'm thinking of coming over to Ireland, can I stay in yours? And I said, absolutely, but I'm not there. He said, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. And so he came over and walked the dogs for the weekend and then went back to Scotland, which was quite interesting. He is, you're a comfortably odd man. But it is dogs. But you had mastiffs, didn't you? I remember seeing a giant dog in your mum's house in Troon.
That would have been Buster, yeah, absolutely, size of a horse. But yeah, so yeah, and she's got another one called Mungo now, but I couldn't cope with mastiffs down here. And also, I think the most important thing for me was to be able to climb mountains or go running with dogs. And mastiffs are extraordinarily lazy creatures. So they would go 10 yards instead. They're front row creatures. They can do short bursts of power, but can't necessarily jog for long periods. So I should say that's props. That's not hookers. Hookers are amazing athletes.
I will accept all that, and I'll take whatever compliment you can give. Have you been back in Troon, Andrew, recently?
I went back once for the first time in 4 months. The longest time, well, except when I was a student and I lived in France for a bit, the longest time I'd ever been away from Scotland. And so I went back last week with the intention of... going up and filming in the mountains, actually, with the dogs. And so I went up, saw my mum, my family, then went up to the mountains and had comfortably the worst day ever in the mountains. So I never go climbing in the summer because I'm in, you know, it's midges, it's tourists, it's everything. And it was all those things. And it rained and it was just horrendous. So I'm drawing a veil over that one, pretending it never happened. And I'll go back in a couple of weeks' time.
So I would always have said, Joe, that... when Andrew arrived on the scene, that he had the most perfect voice for commentary, but he has another voice as well for one of his illustrious neighbours. Would you give us a bit of a blast of that, Andrew?
The thing is, I'm struggling with my voice. The last few days, my voice almost disappeared, so it's just coming back now. I can't do a Colin Montgomery impression on this. I didn't call him. Yes, it is. It is very much so. Very much so. Okay, that's good. Good lad. Good lad to have all that that talent, if you like, and to have not won a major, a senior major, if you like. I have. Very good. Good. Okay. Good to see you. Good to see you, Joe. Oh, God. Oh my God. So when I came out, I thought the very worst I'm going to be talking about dogs. I'm certainly not going to be doing bad impressions of Colin Montgomery, but here we are. So this is what is what we've all been driven to. This is the, as I say, the whole world of crazy that we're all in just now.
There's not much rugby to talk about, so we did do another 20 minutes here on dogs and Montgomery.
But what about, I mean, rugby, I still can't quite work out how the season's going to be playing out in October and November, because obviously you've got the new Northern Hemisphere, not Northern Hemisphere tournament, the new sort of autumn tournament whereby Fiji and Japan, whoever come over as well, and trying to finish off the Six Nations. In fact, I've still got an Ireland match to do. I think I was due to do Ireland-Italy. Then I've got Wales, Scotland still to do. So it's all a bit mad, but you could say that about everything at the moment.
This is true. Are you an impressionist generally, by the way, or is Montgomery a one-off special?
Bad Montgomery, is it? No, I used to do quite a good Montgomery, but I've lost it. I've lost it completely. But I don't... the funny thing about doing commentary is that it's your own voice, but you're putting on a bit of a performance anyway. So when I'm talking normally... I mean, I probably don't speak quite like this when I'm talking normally to, you know, my other half or to family or friends or whatever. I mumble away even more than this, which is impossible to believe. But then when the microphone goes on as well, you give yourself a bit more clarity and a bit more, the diction's a bit sharper and it's just a bit more energy about it. So it's all a bit of an act. It's all a little bit of not an impression of what you believe commentators to be. I like it when commentators are as natural as they can be. And there was a sort of time for a while that all sports commentators in the UK tended to do the sort of Alan Partridge-esque commentary, and that's why it was so accurate, because it was just, look at that, it's just exciting, what an exciting game this is.
Yeah.
And you go, what are you talking about? Why are you speaking like that? Do you speak like that normally when you're in normal life? Just give me your normal voice, give me enthusiasm and excitement with your normal voice. But maybe that is how you speak, I don't know, but it just seems to be, I don't know how it is in Ireland, but there was a sort of perception of, I'm a sports broadcaster, this is what I'm supposed to sound like. A bit like a disc jockey, a radio presenter in the 80s and 90s as well. There's a lot of mid-Atlantic drawls suddenly came out, and it was all, wow, what a great track that was, and this one coming up, you're going to love it as well. And it's, what? Why are you speaking like that? So you can hear my voice is getting a bit husky. I'm not emotional at all this chat here. I mean, I am quite emotional. But you know what I mean? It's just sports broadcaster is that thing that, sports broadcaster. But it's I like people to be as natural as they can be.
I think the Irish broadcasters in times past were all pretty natural. I mean, the only one that was truly overly excitable was Jimmy McGee. But if you ever met Jimmy on the street, he was more excitable on the street than he was on television. He was the most amazing. He had an amazing voice. He had an amazing memory. He was excited by sport. And I think a lot of the guys that get that across. But look, I think we were blessed in many respects working with Bill McLaren back in the day and having that voice and having an unhurried commentary where he was quite happy to take a break and a pause. He didn't have to fill every moment. But when he spoke, it tend to have been thoughtful, you know, and well organized in his brain before it came out.
But, you know, I watch, you know, when I end up now watching, I don't actually do that. I'm often watching American golf late at night. You know, it's a CBS commentary or whoever it might be. In fact, American sports commentary is so different because it is just a talking competition. He said something, so I'd better say something. Or she said something, I'd better say something. And they all end up just talking over each other. And Woody will tell you, you know, one of our golden rules in our sports broadcasting commentary is you never talk over each other or try to avoid it. It just sounds horrible to the listeners or to the viewer's ear. So it's got a certain element of discipline about it. It's a little, you know, you'll prod somebody, you know, and say, I've got something to say, or just a raised eyebrow or a look, say, I'll come in and say something now. So you're dovetailing nicely rather than talking over each other. And as Woody says there, you know, there's no damage in putting the mic down. Quite often that's actually, you know, very much the best thing you can do, because how can you improve on the sound of a stadium? How can you improve on the crowd? You can't. That's the best commentary you can do. I was doing the Masters when the BBC still had Live, bless it, and it was Justin Rose and Sergio Garcia coming down the stretch, head-to-head, brilliant tussle. They got to Sergio Garcia was on the 15th, and it is second shot to this par 5 over the water. And he comes up over the ball, and we were commentating. It was Peter Allison, me, and Ken Brown, and Paul Leisinger. And Garcia comes over this shot, the second shot, when I think they were tied or he was one behind. And you set it up, and then you set it free. You just leave it to play out in itself. You can't add anything more than the sort of almost imperceptible buzz of the crowd and a little bit of bird song and that atmosphere that you can feel, and you can just almost hear the atmosphere without saying anything. And just as he was about to hit, Azinger lifts his microphone up as if he's about to say something. And yeah, lovely man, Paul Azinger, but I just put out a hand and said, you know, I didn't say anything, but I put out a hand to stop him because there was nothing he could have said. Great player, fantastic man that he is. There's nothing he could have said at that moment to add to the quality of what the silence was providing, because that's quite often happens in rugby. And you get it when Johnny Sexton's over a kick at the Aviva. You know, the silence is perfect because it just sums up the drama of that moment and the pressure of that moment. And that's why the silence in sports commentary is sometimes far, far better than any line we can come up with.
I suspect you were a fan then of Jim Nance at the end of the 19 Masters when Woods won. And I think it was 4 minutes and not a word, which was just amazing.
Yeah, and he would be one of the very few that would be allowed to do that. That's changing now, and it's coming into our broadcasting as well, in that people are scared of silences, as if, oh, why is nobody talking? What's wrong? You know, you get in tennis, you're actually quite encouraged to do it. You know, why would I need to say anything for two games? You've got the score up there. You've got the umpire as a commentator. The crowd, they're commentators. That all is commentary. That's all soundtrack that you don't need to add to. So why do you need to say anything? You come in maybe at a change of ends and chat about something. But again, tennis commentary in America is very much, they've added an extra commentator. They put a commentator down behind the umpire's chair. So, and they feel, oh, I've got to say something to justify my role as well. So less is definitely more. You know, radio is obviously different, but television, you can suffocate the pictures, so just let it breathe. But we live in a busier, louder time now, and people kind of demand that sort of higher pace. And like Woody was saying with Bill McLaren, you kind of long for that. Commentators like Barry Davis, who wouldn't, you know, you don't need to say much, just a little phrase to help the pictures along.
Sorry, Azinger react, Andrew?
No, he didn't. I mean, he didn't say anything, but No, he's fine. I think he's confident, and he's confident enough in his own ability. But we just come from different schools of broadcasting, and also a lot of ex players who become commentators. They aren't necessarily, quite often they aren't, when they meet with editors, the editors aren't going to say to them, as they would to someone like me who's a broadcaster, this is how we do it, this is how we do it. The best of the editors would do that, but quite often they're almost a little bit cowed by the big name. So we've got the big name, we're excited to have the big name, so we'll let the big name kind of have free rein to do what they want. Whereas everybody, all the best ex-players, ex-sports people that I know in terms of commentary are people who've been willing to sort of learn, and I haven't got an ego that says, no, I know what I'm doing here. You know, Paul O'Connell, when Woody stopped doing stuff with the BBC, in terms of an Irish voice, the BBC went to Paul O'Connell, I think, and one of the great things about him was that he would call up and say, how can I get better? What can I do? What do you want me to do? It wasn't a case of, I'm Paul O'Connell, I know the game, I don't really need to. It was very, tremendously modest character who would say, was that okay? What can I do to get better? And that, you just love working with people like that.
French and philosophy at the University of Glasgow. So clearly you were out to make the big books from early on, career in high finance beckoned. When did broadcasting come on your radar? How did all that happen?
When I realised I was qualified for nothing else with French and philosophy, it was. I chose those subjects at university because I was young and pretentious and thought, French. I mean, genuinely, it was because modern languages. I mean, I was quite good at languages at school, but modern languages at university had 215 people in the first year intake, and 15 of them maximum were blokes. So I thought, well, I mean, come on, I can't lose. But remarkably, I did lose over a few years. So and then philosophy was just to try and appear deeper and more meaningful to all those women who I was being unsuccessful with. So qualifying for nothing. I mean, university qualified you for becoming an adult. Again, a lot of people would say I failed in that respect as well. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. So then I worked as a waiter for a year after university. And I was working at a bit of a media hangout restaurant in Glasgow called Regano, just off Buchanan Street. And there were always media people coming in there. And I thought, I'd quite like to work in, it was that shallow. I'd quite like to work in the media. It looks like a good life. But I did love the sound of my own voice. I did love languages. I wanted to do something with language. And I applied for a job with a written press job with DC Thompson, the sort of old publisher based in Dundee. And I applied for a job with a local radio station. I got offered both and I took the broadcasting route. And that was it, local radio for 3 years in Scotland and then came down to London. So, because you can't do, it was all football in Scotland. I mean, all football and pretty much all the Old Firm as well. So if you wanted to do other sports, which I was interested in, you had to go elsewhere. And also you want to be on the biggest stage, and London was the biggest stage in UK terms in terms of broadcasting. So that was it.
Mm. And following Bill McLaren is an impossible task. Did that weigh heavily on you? Bit of a nightmare in some respects.
Yeah, it is. It is exactly that, impossible. And it's like doing the golf with Peter Alice. But what you mustn't do is try and be them. You just try and do your own thing. Because all these voices of sport became so iconic, and they were the voices of those sports because the BBC broadcast everything. So whoever was broadcasting on the BBC was the voice of that sport, whether it be, David Coleman in athletics and Murray Walker in Formula One and Peter O'Sullivan in racing and whoever it might be, and then Peter Alice and Bill McLaren. So to follow any of those giants is impossible. But the sport, even when I was coming into it, all the sports were diffusing so much and going on to so many different channels that there were so many different voices of sport that you weren't really, there wasn't really the pressure on you to, because, and there were other, there's Eddie Butler there, Nick Mullins was there, and so, doing rugby. So all these people, you're all that pressure is kind of dissipated as well because you're not the voice of that sport. You're a voice of that sport. So, but again, don't try and never try.
You were the Scottish voice.
Yeah, exactly.
So that made it very close. And would Bill, I got to know Bill really, really well, and he was a total gent and whatever. And his preparation was phenomenal. I've one of his team sheets match sheets up on the wall in my office because it's just so meticulous. It's so accurate. It's so he would have remembered it all, but he needed to have things at the tip of his fingers. And and I know preparation is key for you. Did you spend time with Bill? Did he give you a hand?
I remember meeting him while I was at Scott FM, the local radio station I worked for in Edinburgh. And I went to Murrayfield. I just went up to say hello and introduced myself. I said, hello, my name is Andrew Cotter, I work for. And no word of a lie, and this is not an apocryphal story or exaggerated in any way, but he said, any relation to J.L. Cotter? And I said, oh, it's my grandfather. And he played twice for Scotland, twice in the 1930s. And Bill remembered him. So I think it was because he was slightly unique in that, if you can be slightly unique, in that he was the only sort of ordained minister ever to have played for Scotland. So there was some sort of unique selling point of my grandfather. But he remembered what position he played. And then after that, he couldn't have been nicer. And one of them sort of... I don't have many regrets. I have thousands of regrets. But one of those regrets was that I was supposed to work with Bill. I never got to work directly with them. But at the 2003 World Cup in Australia, there were two commentators for each home nation sent out from Five Live, BBC Radio Five Live. And the two to commentate in Scotland were due to be Bill and me. And then about a month before that, this was just after he'd retired as television commentator, and then a month before the World Cup, he said, "I'm not up to it. I'm not up to going around Australia for a month, 6 weeks." So he stood down from it. And then I worked with Alistair Eakin, who's a fantastic commentator. It was great, and it was very different because it was two younger guys having a good time around Australia. But to work with Bill, to commentate alongside him, to have him commentate in the first 20 minutes of the half or the second half, or to me hand over to him to commentate, you know, to take you through to full time, he was Bill McLaren. Yeah, it would have been fantastic. But he was very, very nice. He was very, very helpful. He was everything you would expect him to be, and everything that sort of Woody will know as a player.
Well, I was going to touch on that because Bill played favourites, and I know I've said this story before, but if you asked any rugby player, any international rugby player, did they know what a hike ball was? And if they said yes, you could be guaranteed that Bill had given them a hike ball, and that he was one of, or they, that player was one of his favourites. If they didn't know what it was, Bill didn't like them. No. And he never wanted to say he didn't like somebody, but that was his way of doing it. If he didn't give you one, if you didn't know what they were. And he had a cracking relationship. He once said to me, and early on, I think, because I started working with the BBC when I got injured when I was 23 or 24, and I worked with him a little bit, and it was fantastic. But he was trying to get in to see the Irish team at a closed training session. And media were absolutely not allowed in, and Bill came with Joe McCusker, the producer, and just said, "Look, is there any chance?" And so I got Bill in to watch the closed session, and we were playing Scotland, right? So it was a kind of a tough one to bring in. And he said, "Listen, you've five new players. I just need to see the shape of their head up close, and then I'll know them on the field." And of course, you'd let him in because he was the master, really. Do you have that relationship with the teams? Do you get to know the players?
No, I did. In fact, the last time I knew the players that well, the last time I knew the players really well was the 2003 Rugby World Cup. And that seems a long time ago, but, you know, we travelled with the teams and we stayed in the same hotels, and they were the same age as me, effectively. So guys, you know, like Gregor Townsend or Kenny Logan or whoever, they were all my contemporaries in terms of age. So, we had fun. And the game has changed totally. Not the game, everything around the game has changed so much that you're never allowed in to see training sessions now. You get to see 5 minutes of a captain's run, and the captain's run, you know, and the bits that you get to see are them sort of walking on, milling around and making phone calls on the pitch. So it's not, you don't get to see them train. There is an argument, though, that you don't need to see them train, because there is so much footage now of them available to you. Whereas in Bill's day, he would have had VHS tapes of previous games, or he would be able to see them play for their clubs, perhaps, very rarely, or he would have to go into training to see them. And as Keith says, you know, you have to see the way players are running. You can't be looking for what's the number on the back, or if they've even got a name on the back. You can't, you haven't got time to look for that or hope that they turn round, because the game's moving so quickly. If you can't identify every single player very, very sharply, then you're in trouble. So you need to be able to see the way they are they're moving. But I also quite like, not quite like, what you do miss is you miss chatting to the coaches and just getting a little bit of snippet of information. And perhaps I'm a little bit more lax on that than I should be. But also, I think it's quite healthy to have a bit of a detachment as well from the players. So I've been in a position before commentating on Scotland, you know, especially back earlier on when those players I've mentioned were still playing, that if they made a mistake, I wouldn't want to say, oh, what a howler by Kenny Logan. Bless you, Kenny, you made some. I'm joking. So, you should always have that objectivity, that detachment. And the players now, you know, I've just turned 47. And the players, you know, some of the players look 47, but they're 22 years old. They've never been outside in life. They've never been outside a gym or a hotel or a training field or whatever. So it's very difficult for me to have things in common with them. So there is that detachment, and I see them purely as rugby playing machines now, which is a shame in a way. It'd be lovely if we could go back to the amateur days where you were mixing with the players and having a drink and being in the hotels and having fun. But again, as we said, with many things, the world has changed. And I wonder how Bill would have, if he would have enjoyed it. I suspect, like a lot of people of that vintage, he wouldn't have enjoyed this kind of game so much, or the culture around it, because it's like post-match interviews, or you very rarely get stuff. Rugby, you'll still get, compared to football, you'll still get better stuff in rugby. But whenever big, big money is involved, like football or like golf or like tennis, you very rarely get anything interesting from the players. And a lot of that has been lost from sports coverage.
And how have your enjoyment levels of the job changed over the years?
That's an interesting question, because you can't do it for 20 years and not sometimes feel, sometimes it's not jaded at all, that's too strong a word, but sometimes it's a little bit of here we go again, because it's the same tournament. But the thing is, even if it's the same tournament, the same championship, the story is different. So you might say, oh, I'm going through the prep again, which you've got to do. You've got to do that prep, because you're a tremendous responsibility as someone who's there to bring that game and that passion. It doesn't matter what you feel about on that particular day, what you feel about a team, or how passionate or impassionate you are about that sporting event. The people at home might be the biggest fans in the world and so excited for it. So you've got to convey that passion, that excitement, because you're getting paid to do so, and you're the luckiest person in the world to be there sitting in that seat, in that stand. So that's what I tell myself that before every single commentary, because again, Woody will confirm, I'm a little bit miserable, but I can't be that person when I'm commentating on sport, because the person sitting at home is not miserable. You know, might be, but you have to convey the enthusiasm and excitement of a sporting contest, no matter how you feel about it. But definitely over the years, you do become a bit more detached from it. I don't watch sport as a fan anymore. Sometimes, very, very rarely, if something is really exciting, I will get lost in the moment. But more often than not, you are watching it and you're thinking so much. You know, I'll watch Scotland play against England, and I promise you, I'm not, during the match, I'm not thinking, oh, come on, Scotland. Afterwards, I will be. Beforehand, I will be. But during it, I'm thinking, who's that? Right, what's a phrase for this? What's happening here? How can I best, as I say, convey the excitement or non-excitement of the match here? How can I convey the atmosphere? So you're thinking and concentrating so hard that you're not watching sport as a fan anymore, which is a bit of a shame, but, you know, that's the job.
The reality of the job, yeah. So
the enjoyment you have, is that helped by the fact that you also do tennis? You're doing the championship at Wimbledon, you're doing the Masters in Augusta, you're supposed to be in Tokyo doing the Olympics now.
Yeah. Well, the variety is everything. If I were doing one sport week in, week out, there's no doubt I would find that more difficult. And that variety, as you say, throughout the summer, you know, it should have been Wimbledon, straight to the Open Championship, straight to the Olympics. You know, do the opening ceremony, do rugby sevens there, do athletics. So everything is something different. That keeps you fresh. There's absolutely no doubt about it. When I started doing athletics was in 2013, and I was so delighted. I mean, I love athletics anyway, but I was so delighted because I went straight to Moscow to do the World Championships, and it was a breath of fresh air. I loved the job I was doing and loved the events I was covering. 100%, but then to throw something new in there. That's when I started doing the boat race in 2011. People go to the boat race. Well, first of all, the boat race gets 6 million viewers because it's the people watch the boat race, and the boat race is as they are now. But it's also, it's so unique, different to anything else. You know, you're in, for a lot of the other events, you're in stadiums, you've got the same, it feels a bit samey. But then you go and do the boat race, and what a challenge it is to broadcast that, to explain it to 6 million people watching. Well, how many of those are expert rowers or experts on the Thames Tideway and the you know, the vagaries of that? So you've got to, it's a challenge to sort of explain all that. So yeah, the variety is hugely important.
6 million, that's Olive and Mabel on a bad day. I mean, whatever. So BBC, look, I mean, you rightly say that there won't be the voice of a sport anymore because the landscape is changing so much. And that's accelerating at the moment, I'm sure you've noticed. CVC are circling around rugby and the Six Nations. Yeah. The golf has changed and is changing dramatically. You know, the Open and the BBC, you just kind of can't believe where we're headed. It feels like that's only going one way. Can you see a point in the next 10 years where the Beeb will effectively have no live sport, maybe bar what, the Olympics and the World Cup, maybe a European Championships?
Well, I mean, if I'm being realistic, then it's, you know, it's a money game. And especially when times are tough in the world, then it comes down more and more to money. Quite often, if economies around the world are booming and we're in a time of success, then governing bodies can be more altruistic and say, no, we are not going to take the quick, fast money because we want to grow our game. But then if things are tough, as they're going to be for the next few years, and whoever it is, you know, as you say, CVC or whoever it is, I was going to say QVC, their shopping channel, if they're offering big, big money for rugby, then of course the governing body is going to be interested in taking just the biggest money from it. So if CBC own the Six Nations and they are their money men, then, you know, what are they going to do? Are they interested in the improvement of the game? Are they interested in people playing the game, or are they interested in making money? So it is worrying, there's no doubt about that. And as far as the BBC goes, I mean, I can't speak for the BBC, but I know that they are interested in holding on to certain events, and they will fight very hard for those events. But there are other events which, you know, are no longer a priority. So, yeah, it's sad, but it's kind of inevitable. As you say, there are so many companies involved now, and not one company can do all of them. But it is the new companies coming in terms of Amazon. I mean, the pockets of Amazon are just extraordinarily deep. And, you know, BBC is a publicly funded body. So, and people say, you know, why do I pay my license fee if the BBC isn't going to show me sport? Well, it's because they're trying to pay for drama and news and entertainment as well. So much that we'd love it to be all sports, lots of people don't like sports and they want something else. So the BBC has to cater for everything. And at the same time, try to pare back as well, because they're under all sorts of pressure from the government and from those who want to scrap the license fee. So I think, I mean, the next 10 years are going to be fascinating.
No, for sure. There's a couple,
but that's why, actually, yeah, that's on. What I was thinking, that that's why something like, you know, I mean, that's why something like, and it sounds remarkably silly, but doing something like commentating on dogs, and suddenly you realize you can be your own broadcaster and you can put stuff on YouTube. And it's a whole new world. If a youngster were asking me, how do I get into broadcasting now? You know, 10 years ago, I'd have said, well, you start working on a local paper, or you go to a local radio station. Whereas now I would say, start your own channel, do your own thing, produce your, make your own content. You know, it won't be great at the start, but you will build and build an audience if you're good enough, and, you know, you'll start to maybe build a reputation. You know, I see it in every sport that the governing bodies say, right, who's the influencer in this sport? Who's got the biggest following on YouTube or on Twitter, Instagram, whoever it might be? Right, let's get them involved in covering our sport. So that is the way to go. And that's why I'm desperately trying to jump onto it as a 47-year-old using dogs, basically.
Well, there's a couple of texts in, people have questions. And on that point, Emer says, I'm sorry, but all I can hear is his commentary about Mabel as he's talking. So you've been reduced to Mabel.
But that's the worry. That's definitely a worry. People have said, because I mean, I won't be commentating on sport until... I've got the UK Athletics Championships on the 5th and 6th of September, but you know, it's quiet after that because the Ryder Cup's gone. But whenever I do sports, the next time people are just going to be going, nah, it's just, that's that dog guy. Dog guy.
The dog guy.
But you know what? If that's my lot in life, I'm perfectly happy.
Listen, the first line of your obituary is written. There we are. Somebody wants you to talk to us about Peter Alice and what it was like working with him. I mean, he is. You guys probably grew up worshipping Bill McLaren. For me, I mean, Peter Alice was kind of the guy.
So, Peter Alice was the guy as well for me, not just Bill McLaren, because my sports that I watched were rugby and golf. I was more of a golfer, in fact, than a rugby player, even though, you know, you look at this awesome physique and you think, how could this guy not have been a rugby player? He's amazing. But no, it was golf. So Peter Alice was, as much as Bill McLaren, he was the voice of my childhood. So again, working with him.
Yeah.
Peter is exactly as he comes across. And some people would say, you know, a lot of younger people watching golf now would say, Peter Alice, what a dinosaur. I'll tell you about Peter Alice is sports commentary, especially in the slower sports, is about observation. It's about telling stories as well. Mm. And there is nobody better in terms of timing, in terms of observing what is on the screen in front of him, which is so often ignored by people who are commentating. It's not about what you are trying to say or what fact you want to get out or what line you've prepared and you want to shoehorn in. It's about watching what is on the screen in front of you, because that's what the viewers are seeing at home. And it's about reacting to that and perhaps coming up with something that, you know, the viewer hasn't thought of. It's in a way that a player is walking down the fairway. Peter loves walks. It's about all of that. It's just, you know, I remember seeing Justin Rose with all this advertising, all the sponsors on his shirt. And, you know, Peter just says, oh, there's half an hour's light reading on Justin Rose's shirt. And it's just, it's a very simple thing, but it's just a beautiful line that, you know, you suddenly go, oh, that, you know, that kind of sums it up perfectly. He's he wouldn't know the stats and the figures about the modern players, but he would say, that's not my job. I'll leave that to you or to Ken or to Paul Eisinger. But his job is to observe, and he's a lovely, lovely, lovely voice. And again, it goes back to that slightly slower, easier time of watching sport, where you had time and it breathed and you sat down for a few hours and you watched the golf, and it was just a thing of beauty. I loved it. I love working with them.
Yeah. I know, Keith, you love your golf as well. I presume you're sat at home enjoying the Masters. It's Peter Alice and the Masters, and now with Andrew as well, is still incredibly nice, comforting television. And that's, I mean that in the best possible sense.
Well, my favourite television was Peter Alice and the Open and the Masters. Bill McLaren and our own Fred Cogley. I loved Fred Cogley, and he was kind of on RTE, the voice of my childhood. But when we'd be watching other games, it was always Bill. I got to meet Peter a couple of times, and he is a force of nature, and he's quite magnificent, you know. And it is, and it's funny because he carries himself incredibly. He's the most comfortable man you've ever seen.
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
What comes across on the screen is actually what's going through his head or what he is looking at. And he was a magnificent golfer, and still talks in some of that old-fashioned way of golf, about the wristy golfers and not about the power. And he gets excited when he sees a shot being crafted and not muscled. You know, and he is a proper old fogey, and he's still entirely relevant because he gives a sense of what's actually happening in real time.
But we have a tendency nowadays to ignore an audience if they're over 50 years old. And there's a real clamour. We've got to get the youth audience. And yeah, you've got to get young people into sport. Of course, you've got to get young people into sport. But don't neglect, you know, a viewer or a listener who is beyond 50, 60, 70 years old. They matter just as much. So there really is a fashion at the moment for neglecting them and neglecting sports which might not be that interesting to the younger audience. And golf has certainly fallen into that trap. Because I know we know what the demographic is at the BBC. You get the figures, and golf is watched by an older audience, but it's still a very valid audience. These are still people; they pay the license fee. So, you know, we're all heading that way. I don't know. I do despair of it a little bit, but again, that's just the way of the world at the moment.
We are out of time, unfortunately.
Do you want to see a dog? Do you want to see an Oliver, a Mabel?
Oh, if you've got 10 seconds, let us have it, yeah.
Olive, come on. Come on. Come on. Olive, come on. Come on. Come on.
And where's Mabel? Mabel's not turned up. No, she's not turned up. Well, there you go.
We're honoured. We're honoured. And the radio listeners, you've missed out big time there. 45 minutes has zipped by. We've actually cancelled something we were meant to do because we didn't want to interrupt that. But we have to end it now. So Keith, as ever, thank you. And Andrew Cotter, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Cheers. Thanks, sir. Cheers. All the best.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.